Now, they married up with the foreign policy hawks, the Wolfowitzes and the Pearls and the Cheneys and the Rumsfelds, who have been waiting 30 years for this revolution to cement in order to bring forward their very aggressive foreign policy. And they don't have often a lot in common with the religious right. But they've come together in common cause. And they believe that the U.S. is destined to be the world's sole superpower and should not be ashamed to use its might to promote its values and interests around the world. And, of course, it's under this group that George W. Bush announced a first strike policy, whereby the United States can strike first at any country whose values it disagrees on values. And of course, backing all of this are the big business interests that are making a killing under the new regime, and that is energy, security, what they call data mining, because what they want in the end is to have information on every living, breathing person on Earth, all put in master computers so that they then mine this information to see if they can figure out what kind, you know, who might be a terrorist and to cross-fertilize this information. And, of course, defense. And the defense spending has dramatically increased under George Bush. And I outline in the book the deeply close relationship between the large defense companies like Lockheed Martin and the Pentagon. And it's just an open revolving door. One day you're the corporate VP of, you know, one of the big defense companies. The next day you're a senior advisor in the Pentagon, or maybe you didn't even quit your job and you're a senior advisor anyway. These people are making policy. And there has been a massive buildup of defense in this term. This year alone, I estimate, I just put all the sort of different stats together, 2005-2006, that the United States will spend U.S. $1 trillion between its military budget, its war in Iraq, and its war on terror. $1 trillion. So, of course, what it's doing is sucking up all of the infrastructure and the social structures and education funding and so on from its people in order to pay for that. Of course, we saw that in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. Bush refuses not only to reduce the nuclear stockpile, but he's dramatically increased it. And, in fact, they are now taking the arms race into space. When they were first elected in their first term, Rumsfeld was put in charge of a task force on space. And he warned of a space Pearl Harbor and said the United States has to get there first and maintain superiority. You can ask, I mean, you don't listen to me. You can. I quote at least half a dozen of these senior guys, but I mean, scratch any of them. This is not, you know, this isn't a secret or anything. General Lance Lord, who's chief of the Air Force Space Command, says, and I quote, "Space superiority is essential to our vision of controlling and fully exploiting space to provide our military with an asymmetric advantage over our adversaries. Space superiority may not be our birthright, but it is our destiny. It is the American way of fighting." Or as Rumsfeld also says, "We got there first. We've got space superiority. We like it, and we're going to keep it." Now, to pay for this war, as I say, Bush has made war on a different kind of war on his own people. In the area of human rights, through his Homeland Security Act, through the Patriot Act, he has created a frightening, frightening situation in the United States. He has created what people are now calling an American gulag, prisons both on American soil and around the world where people are treated abominably. And, of course, through his practice of rendition, suspected terrorists are, or even anybody who might know anybody who might have once known anybody who's a terrorist, are disappeared into prisons in Syria and Egypt and other places where they are tortured or disappeared. I quote one CIA operative who says, well, it goes like this. We tell the interrogators what we want to know in the morning, and by the evening we have the information. There are now 5 million people on the U.S. Master Terror Watch List, and they include environmentalists, human rights activists, and civil libertarians. William Schultz, who's the head of Amnesty International, says that the Bush administration has taken the U.S. back to a time before human rights were part of the political vocabulary of that country. On the environment, appalling, appalling record. They have massively deregulated environmental infrastructures. It started in Texas when George Bush was governor, and he brought in introduced the first law to allow large corporate sectors to negotiate with the government their own environmental agreements. And basically, he then said, go and do it or don't do it. Report on yourselves or don't report on yourselves. Pay the fine or don't pay the fine. I don't care. He brought all those people into the White House with him, and they have mercilessly slashed environmental infrastructure. Robert Kennedy Jr. says that Bush and company have launched over 400 major rollbacks of U.S. environmental law, including the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. And he says that they have taken the country back decades to a time before ecological consciousness. The assault on families and the working families and the poor are just astounding. And the difference between social classes is breathtaking. In 1960, the wealthiest 20% made 30 times as much as the bottom 20%. Now the top 20% makes 75 times as much. The top 10% in the United States owns two-thirds of the wealth, leading the bottom 90% to own and divide up one-third between them. I went to write stats in a different part of the book about Latin America, and I went to say what we always say, which everybody says, which is the deepest inequality in the world is in Latin America. And I wrote down the new stats, and I went back to the stats on the United States, and I thought that's no longer true. The greatest disparity, income disparity in the world is now in the United States. Mm-hmm. Under George Bush, the United States among developed countries ranks dead last in fighting poverty, is at the bottom in terms of functional literacy, has one of the lowest levels of life expectancy, the greatest and most permanent income inequality, and the highest number of citizens without access to health care. They also, at 22% of children living in poverty, are only marginally better than Mexico. The federal minimum wage at $5.15 an hour has not been raised in almost a decade, and 90 million Americans are what they call twice poor, which means that even if you doubled their income, they would still be living below the poverty line. And this stat just blew me away. The Bush administration has cut welfare payments every year since the year 2000 by 13% per year. Can you imagine trying to be a family working with one, two, three jobs to just make ends meet, or getting sick on one of your jobs and losing whatever small insurance you might have had around health care and trying to turn to that system? While profits from corporations are soaring and CEOs are taking home unprecedented salaries, the cost of living has grown faster than income for most working families who are now living with historic levels of debt. Now, to stay competitive in the global economy so beloved of the Bush team, American workers are being told to take huge cuts or lose their jobs. I'll give you as an example the workers at Delphi Corporation, which is an auto parts company. They have been asked to take a two-thirds cut in their wage or see their plants across the United States close. How's that for do you want to be shot or hanged? Now, what's this going to mean for Canada? Well, it's already had very serious implications. We have already started to merge our systems around security and defense and in a whole host of other areas. We've brought in C-36, which is a draconian piece of legislation, and I've got a whole chapter called Enemy Creep on what we've done in this country and how dangerous it is. We've brought in something called the Safe Third Country Act, which is that we now have to turn back refugees who, largely from Latin America, who have to come across the United States to seek refugee status in Canada. We're now required to turn them back at the border. Many of them are escaping the kinds of paramilitary squads that have been supported by the American administration, and they're being turned back to try to seek asylum there. Well, you can imagine, of course, they're just being sent back to their country of origin. And we have the Patriot Act. Murray mentioned this. You should know that the Patriot Act says that any American corporation operating anywhere in the world, on U.S. soil or anywhere else, must share with the Homeland Security Department whatever information it requests on their files, if requested. They cannot say no. And Lockheed Martin, the world's weapons second, I think, biggest weapons manufacturer, has the contract to deliver the hardware for the Canadian Census. This, you know, these are the folks that designed the missile guidance system, you know, the warhead. And I don't like the thought that they have my postal code, you know, and your postal code. The Stats Canada says, well, don't worry, we won't let them share that information. Lockheed Martin gets billions and billions of dollars from the Pentagon. They're going to turn around and say no if this information is requested. The Civil Liberties Monitoring Group in Canada says Canada is creating an irreversible and incremental process that will alter forever the fundamental values, civil liberties, and constitutional guarantees that Canadians until now have viewed as the pillars of Canadian democracy, particularly with regard to due process, the right to privacy, and legitimate political dissent. On the issue of defense, it is true that we said no to ballistic missile defense, and that's because Paul Martin, in spite of his desire to do so, to say yes to it, and his promise that I think he did make to the United States, was forced to listen to the Canadian people and read the polls as he's in a minority situation. However, you should know, and also this did not get much press, but in this past April, they finally published the long-awaited foreign policy review, and it mirrors almost identically the foreign policy position of the Canadian Council of Chief Executives, including a recommendation for a North American security and defense partnership. I believe they're bending over backwards to make up for the decision not to participate in ballistic missile defense. You should know that Paul Cellucci, who's the former ambassador from the United States to Canada, says his only instruction from George Bush when he was sent to Canada was to get Canada to increase its military spending. And we have just announced that spending in the recent budget of a few months ago. The increase will be to $20 billion a year for the military, which is the highest per capita spending on military since the Second World War in our country. Now, this is all so that we can fulfill our new agreement on interoperability of both technology and strategy. And this is an agreement that has been made between our countries. And it's coming at the expense of our support for the UN. Steve Staples at the Polaris Institute estimates that 12 years ago, for every $10 that we spent on military and defense, over $9 was on UN peacekeeping. Now, for every $10 we spend only 31 cents on military, on UN peacekeeping.